It's recording.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this piece of the Talmud class, Rabbi Wechsler's portion of the Talmud class for the month of January. It's a pleasure to see you again, to welcome you, and I hope that you have all been well since we had a chance to talk last. Now, when Rabbi Bolton spoke with me about teaching, and we talked about the idea of doing something in January, because I was away quite a while, I didn't get back till after the first week in December, and I didn't think that was a good time to start anything. I said, you know, what I'd really like to do is to try to touch the waters for the first time of Chapter 2 of Chagiga. Chapter 2 of Chagiga. Now, let me tell you why I was interested in that. I've never taught this material before, but it's one of my favorite pieces of Talmud. Chapter 2 of the Tractate of Chagiga, at least the first part of the chapter, is a chapter about mysticism. It is the classic source of mysticism in the Talmudic period. You have little pieces of mysticism that come up elsewhere in the Talmud, but nowhere in so concentrated a form as in approximately these five pages of this tractate of Chagiga. So I thought it would be fun. First of all, it's not too long. We have four sessions. And we'll have a good time. You'll see some of the things that you've always heard about, stories that you kind of always knew. They come from here. And we'll be taking a look at them. Also, one of the reasons why I was interested in teaching this is that, frankly, for the first time in the 20th and now especially the 21st century, we frankly understand this material as it's never been understood until now. We simply have access to early literature which pre-modern scholars did not have access to. We have manuscripts that come, first of all, the published editions of the Apocrypha, that piece of the Bible that's not in our Bible, it's in a Catholic Bible. The Pseudepigrapha, similarly, you'll find it in a Catholic Bible, but not in a Jewish Bible. This is literature that is, in a way, post-biblical, comes after the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, but pre-Talmudic. Turns out that some of the issues discussed in the Talmud are really best understood when you look at some of those sources. Not only that, there have been important discoveries in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And the Dead Sea Scrolls have enabled us to get a more textured understanding of what was going on in the period of the rabbis of the Talmud, the early period of the rabbis of the Talmud, in the first and the second centuries of this era. So, frankly, if you look at the Art Scroll edition, Art Scroll knows nothing of the scholarly work that's been done. So some of the things that the Art Scroll is very, very good in classical sources, basically up through the beginning of the 19th century. Anything that happens after that is considered to be too modern and probably dangerous and heretical. So art school has its real values, because a lot of important things, a lot of important commentaries come before the 19th century. But frankly, in this particular area where we have learned so much in very recent times, it's important to be able to provide an additional level of commentary. So that is why I was drawn to this material. And now let me say a few words about what you should have, and we'll get quickly to the text itself. The Tractate of Chagiga is a small tractate of the Talmud, which fits into the Seder of Moed. Remember that the Talmud, when we talk about the Talmud, is based structurally on the structure of the Mishnah. The Mishnah, which was edited in the year 200 CE by Rabbi Judah the Prince. The Mishnah is divided into six orders, Shas, Shisha Sfarim, the six orders of the Mishnah. The first order is Zeraim, dealing with all the agricultural laws of the land of Israel, of which there are many. The first tractate of which we have studied, which is Brachot. That is the only non-agricultural tractate in the Seder, in the order of Zeraim. It is also the only tractate in the order of Zeraim that has any Gemara to it, any Talmud that's connected to it. The rest does not, except in the Yerushalmi, the Jerusalem Talmud. When we study the Babylonian Talmud never dealt with the agricultural laws of the land of Israel because it was not relevant to them. They didn't live in the land of Israel. Okay, they didn't live there, and so they didn't study that in the same way that the Israelis did. In the Jerusalem Talmud, which was edited and published in the land of Israel, there is Gemara, and frankly, only in recent years has that come to be studied more and more. It is being studied more and more. The second order of the Mishnah of the Talmud is called Moed, and that is that section which is all about the sacred times of the year. Everything relating to anything that has to do with the sacred times of the year, beginning with the Tractate of Shabbat. It is the largest of the tractates in the order of Moed, and then going from there to Eruvim, which is also a very large tractate, which is related to one particular area of the laws of Shabbat. Generally speaking, in any of the orders of the Mishnah, as I said, there are six of them, in any of the orders, this one deals with the sacred times and festivals. More or less, it's not always true, but more or less, the tractates appear in size order. So Shabbat is the biggest, that's the first tractate. Eruvin is the second biggest, it's the second tractate. So you know that by the time you get to the smaller tractates, they're toward the end. Okay? Now, the Tractate of Chagiga doesn't deal with mysticism. It's not really the subject of the tractate, except for this one small portion. It deals with the Chagiga. The Chagiga. What is a Chagiga? Chagiga was a festal offering. Right? The Torah says that when you come to Jerusalem, you must come three times a year. And when you come, you shall not come empty-handed. Okay? So there is a requirement to bring an olat re'iyah, an olah, which is a sacrifice, an offering that will be offered entirely upon the altar itself. You don't derive any benefit from it. Okay? That's called an olah. An olah literally is a burnt offering, but what it means is that whatever offering you bring is consumed entirely, well, whatever is put there is consumed entirely. Some of it goes to the priest, actually, but it's basically consumed on the altar. You don't get any part of it. That's one thing that you have to do. You have to bring an olat re'iyah when you come to the temple. You also have to bring a chagiga. Because, again, of words in the Torah. The Torah says, v'chagotem. you shall celebrate, and that is understood to refer to a festal offering. You know about that, as a matter of fact. You may not have brought any offerings to the temple in Jerusalem for two reasons. First, there is no temple in Jerusalem. It's a very good reason why you haven't brought it. Secondly, you may not come to Jerusalem on the festivals. Some of us are privileged to be able to do that. Every once in a while, I see one or two of you, and you may even come on the festival. Okay? But there is no temple. Okay? But you know how you know it? You know about it because of the Seder plate. The Seder plate. Right? What's on the Seder plate? The Seder plate, you have a shank bone that is to remember what? As the Zeroa was the offering of the Paschal Lamb. The Korban Pesach, the Paschal Lamb. And then there is an egg, a roast egg. What is that there for? To remember the Chagigah. That is there because of the Chagigah offering that you had to bring. And the Chagigah offering, you would then feast on it yourself. You would feast on the Chagigah offering. Okay? Now, there are very few verses that deal with this in the Torah itself. Very few verses. As a matter of fact, so few that in the first chapter of Chagigah, the last Mishnah goes like this. Heter nidarim porchim b'avir. There is, in the study of law, the law of being able to permit vows, like Kol Nidre. You know, Kol Nidre, comes Kol Nidre, and we say, all the vows that we have made in the year gone by, they shall be null and void. Well, how can we say that? How can we say that? Where do you find scriptural basis for such things? Well, the Mishnah says, Heter nidarim porchim b'avir. The laws that permit us to free a person from vows, porchim b'avir, they fly in the air. In other words, we don't know where they are. these are hovering kinds of laws. It's a funny Mishnah to talk about the things that way. The Ein lehem al mashi yismochu. There's nothing in Scripture on which to base them. Right? Not for the rabbis to admit that. It's interesting. Hilchot Shabbat, the laws of Shabbat, Chagigot, and the laws of Chagigot, the Hami'ilot, and laws that are brought for certain types of trespasses. Harei hein keharerim atluyim b'sara. They are like mountains hanging on a hair. In other words, you have a word or two or three or a verse here and there of Scripture, and you have the biggest masechet of the whole Talmud. It's about next to no Scripture. It's like mountains hanging on a hair. Okay? Shehein mikramu at v'halachot merubot. Because there is very little Scripture and a tremendous amount of halacha. Hadinim v'ha'avodot. Monetary law, the ha'avodot, and laws concerning sacrifices, ha'toharot, laws concerning purity and impurity, the ha'tumot, impurity, the arayot, laws concerning forbidden sexual relations, Leviticus 18, yesh lahem al ma shiyismochu. There is Scripture on which to base those things. Okay? Hein, hein, gufei Torah. They are laws which are by the body of the Torah. The body of the Torah. Okay? So, as is the want of the Talmud, the Mishnah has just mentioned to us that there are laws that are not very grounded, there are laws that are grounded in the Scriptures, and among the things that it just brought up in passing were laws of sexual relations. Well, that's a subject you don't leave easily. You get a chance to talk about that, and especially in the Talmud, or at least even in the Talmud, you don't let a good opportunity go by. so, the very next Mishnah, which is the first Mishnah of chapter 2, is what we are going to study. Okay? And that begins, Ein Dorshin Ba'arayot B'Shlosha. Now that I've mentioned to you the laws of sexual relations, you should know that they cannot be taught except in a group of three. I mean, sorry, they cannot be taught in a group of three. They cannot be taught in a group of three. Now, we'll get to what that means in just a moment. But I just wanted you to see, as far as the structure of the text goes, that's where it comes from. Okay? You've got Chagigot. You've got these festal offerings. They, in fact, are based on Scripture, whereas certain other things are not so easily based on Scripture. And now we're getting to the Gufei Torah, the laws of Arayot. Arayot are laws of forbidden sexual relations. I quickly said that refers to the detailed laws in Leviticus 18. Leviticus 18. Now you know that too, by the way, if you remember Yom Kippur. That is the reading for the afternoon of Yom Kippur, Leviticus 18. That's Mincha, the Mincha reading of Yom Kippur. Okay, any questions so far? Okay, now if you've purchased the Chagiga, that's great. I saw that the office sent out ways of getting this on the internet. Any way you have it doesn't make any difference to me. It's all the same. Some of the translations may be a little bit better, some a little bit worse. We'll deal with everything here, so don't worry about it.
Leviticus 8,
is Leviticus 19. So it's very interesting, by the way, now that you raise the subject.
Oh,
so you should
get...
Okay, so here's what you should know. Leviticus 20 is a replay of Leviticus 18. Okay? So you've got sexual laws in 18. In 19, you've got these lofty ideas, very lofty ideas about life and the holiness. That's your holiness code. Or that's sort of a practical side, although there are as well their laws about the ritual side of life as well. They're all very well integrated. So that's Leviticus 19. And Leviticus 20 is a replay of 18, which goes through all the sexual laws again, but with their punishments. With their punishments. Okay? So I think that's crucial for understanding Parashat Kedoshim, that really it's sandwiched between two sets of sexual laws. Two sets of sexual laws, because that sets the structure for the Kedusha in the middle. The Kedusha is basically, in Judaism, presupposes, it's all sandwiched in, the bookends of family life. It's all sandwiched in, so the basic presumptions of what that family should be and how it should function. Okay. So let's read. Let's start. This is, if you're following in the art scroll, this is page 11b2. 11b2 in the art scroll. Their introduction is a little bit different from the introduction that I gave you. Ein dorshin ba'arayot bishlosha. Alright? Ein dorshin. When it is not allowed to... Now, dorshin is a loaded term. On the one hand, how do they translate it here? In order to be expounded among three people. Well, let me give you some other possibilities. Dorshin usually has to do with the interpretation of Scripture, where either you will interpret Scripture in order to learn theological ideas or halakha. You have Midrash Halakha and you have Midrash Agadah. Those are two forms of such interpretation. Normally means, though, that you're interpreting a scriptural verse. Okay? So it's a teaching context. It's a teaching context. And here you see that the initial prohibition is that you cannot teach the laws of Arayot. Cannot teach the laws of Arayot in a context of three. In a context of three. Now, I want to look at the Rashi, too. The Rashi is very interesting here. Remember, Rashi is on the inside margin of the Talmud text. So if you're following on the Talmud text, look on the inside margin. Here, the Hebrew page is on the right side, the English page is on the left side. It's about almost halfway down the page on the left side. It says, Ein Dorshim Bishlosha. Okay, Ein Dorshim, they leave out the word, Ariot. Ariot meaning the laws of forbidden sexual relations, cannot be taught with three. Listen, look at the Rashi here. Shnayim v'hu. Shnayim v'hu. So Rashi's initial interpretation of this is that what the Mishnah is saying is, when it says that you can't teach, I kept saying in a context of three, what that means is the teacher is one, and there are two students. The teacher is one, and there are two students. Okay? All right? B'ma'aseh, v'lo b'ma'aseh b'reishit b'shnayim. Nor may ma'aseh b'reishit. The facts of creation cannot be taught between two people. Two people. Bishnayim, I'm reading again in the Rashi now, Echad Bahu. That means there's one teacher and one student. One teacher and one student. V'lo b'nerkava b'yachid. And ma'ase nerkava, the issues of the chariot, the subject of the chariot may not be taught even with one person. And here, again, Rashi, Biachid, Ein Sham Elohu Levado. We're talking about a person who is the teacher learning by himself. Hami de Mefaresh de Azil. No, I skipped. Ovi Mara Mefaresh La. And the Talmud will further explicate this. The Talmud will further explicate this. Now, I don't know about you. That's not what I thought of it. When I read it over, that was not my expectation. I said, if you can't teach this in three, it means you have two pupils. Rashi understands this to mean that you have one pupil. When you can't do Ma'aseh Bereishit in two, I understood that it meant you have two pupils. You have one pupil. You can't do it in two. You have one pupil. Rashi said me, no. It's all one less. Okay? And when we're talking about the Ma'aseh Merkava, the matter of the chariot, of course, we don't know what any of these terms means yet. We'll get to what they mean.
Ezekiel, the first chapter.
Okay. We'll get to that in a second. The chariot. This says the chariot. Okay, I'm just translating it literally for the moment, and we'll see very shortly what it means. You can't teach it even to one, or with one student. Elohim ken ayach chacham u'mevin midato. Unless that person was able to understand it by himself. Okay? That person has to have been able to understand it by himself. And I'm going to go on. And then I'm going to go back and explain some of the terms, but I want to go through the whole Mishnah first. Kol hamistakel ba'arba'a devarihim whoever looks at four things, Fatui Loki Ilu Lo Ba'olam, that person would have been better off if he never came to the world. Okay, never came into the world. Alright, what are those four things? Malamala Ulamata. What is above and what is below. Malifnim Umaliachor. What is before and what is behind. V'chol Shelo Chas Al Kvod Kono. And whoever is not careful about the glory of his Creator, the honor of his Creator, Ratui Lo Shelo Ba'olam, it is better that that person had never come into the world. That's strong statements. Strong statements. Now what are we talking about? Let's go through each of these. First of all, Leviticus 18. Just to refresh your memory a little bit. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the Israelite people and say to them, I am the Lord your God. You shall not copy the practices of the land of Egypt where you dwell, or the land of Canaan to which I am taking you, nor shall you follow their laws. My rules alone shall you observe, and faithfully follow my laws. I am the Lord your God. You shall keep my laws and my rules by the pursuit of which men shall live. I am the Lord. It's made the point, I think, a few times that you're supposed to do just what I'm saying because the Egyptians did differently. Okay? Now, look where it goes from here. I won't read all of it. I'll just read the beginning of it. None of you shall come near any one of his own flesh to uncover nakedness. I am the Lord. Your father's nakedness, that is, the nakedness of your mother, you shall not uncover. She is your mother. Now, all those things, ligalot erva is the Hebrew, to uncover nakedness. That's how it's translated, ligalot erva. These are the laws of arayot, arayot. By and large, although far from entirely, these deal with laws of incest. Okay, these are forbidden family sexual relations. And they cover a certain amount of very concrete ground here. Do not uncover the nakedness of your father's wife. It is the nakedness of your father. Now realize your father's wife doesn't have to be your mother, too. That's different. Okay? You know, it's not only the Oedipus situation sleeping with your mother, but you could also have a situation of sleeping with your father's wife who's not your mother. Okay? So there's certain, some of this is very clear, the nakedness of your sister, your father's daughter, or your mother's, whether born into the household or outside. Okay? If it's a second marriage, she's your half-sister then. Right, can you sleep with her? No, you can't do that. Do not uncover their nakedness. Lo tigale et ervatam. You shall not uncover their nakedness. The nakedness of your son's daughter or your daughter's daughter. Do not uncover their nakedness, for their nakedness is yours. The nakedness of your father's wife's daughter, who has born into your father's household. She is your sister. Do not uncover her nakedness. Do not uncover the nakedness of your father's sister. She is your father's flesh. Okay? It's a lot of very specific stuff here. As soon as I read this to you, I mean, I read this and two things occur to me. Why? You know, is this what you call logical law? Is this is logical, let's say, you shall not steal? And obviously this is different kind of law. Laws of forbidden sexual relations are a different quality of law, I think entirely. And sometimes people will say, well, I don't agree with this one, I don't agree with that one, and so on. Because they're, I think, a different quality of law, number one. Number two, what I think about is, well, let's say you can't sleep with this one. How about her sister? How about her mother? Well, didn't say that. Still seems kind of unseemly, even though it didn't say it. Now, how far can you go with these things? Can you add to them? Once you get started, you might say, I can't get started in the first place. This is not logical law. You know, why do I need this kind of stuff? Something very basic to it, undoubtedly. There's some psychological basis to it. Hard to exactly put your finger on it. But the extension of it is also an issue. To what extent can we extend these laws? Right? That's all I'm going to say for the moment about arayot. You can look at it more carefully. As I said, I think we're somewhat familiar with this because it's read on Yom Kippur, at least if you're around and you're not sleeping on the afternoon of Yom Kippur. Okay? That's arayot. Any questions about that so far?
It says yes. Four things, but they only mention three.
Where's that?
In the Mishnah, it says the following four things, what's above and below, what's before and after, and...
Well, above, below, before, and after.
Then also says whoever has no honor for...
No, that's separate. That's apparently separate. So above, below, before, and behind, those are the four. Okay. Those are the four.
Okay. Yes, unless ma'am. You're going to cover it later, the numbers, 3 and 2 and 1. The 3, would it be, does it mean that it's okay to study that with a greater number? Or
no, definitely not a greater number. Definitely not a greater number. It has to be a lesser number. Okay? Rashi makes that clear, and all the commentators make it clear. What we are saying that you can't do it with 3, and of course you can't do it with 4. All right? Oh. So in other words, it's trying to limit the number. It's limiting it. It's making it a smaller number. Okay? And actually, we'll want to know why. Why would you have such restrictions in a pedagogical framework? What's unusual about these subjects, perhaps, that they should be restricted? Okay? Let's get to the definition of the second. Is Maaseh Bereishit. Maaseh Bereishit. That is actually going to be defined by the Gemara as soon as we get into it, so I'm going to skip that a little bit. You'll see what Bereishit is. But you know Bereishit means creation. So we'll see what the Gemara says about that. The last one, though, is perhaps the strangest of the terms, and therefore you have to know what that's referring to, and Herb mentioned it just a moment ago. That's referring the Maaseh Merkabah. Is referring to what we read in the first chapter of Ezekiel. First chapter of the book of Ezekiel. And then I want to take the time now to read to you. Because that is a most unusual piece of scripture. It's actually read in the synagogue on Parashat Yitro as the Haftarah. So part of it is read. We know a little bit about, you know, some of the pieces of Ezekiel are in the liturgy, but when you read it, it's really quite something to read. Chapter 1 of Ezekiel. In the 30th year, on the 5th day of the 4th month, when I was in the community of exiles by the Chebar Canal, he was among the exiles to Babylonia. So this is taking place in Babylonia. The heavens opened, and I saw visions of God. On the 5th day of the month, it was the 5th year of the exile of King Jehoiachin, the word of the Lord came to the priest Ezekiel, son of Buzi, by the Chebar Canal in the land of the Chaldeans, Babylonia. And the hand of the Lord came upon him there. I looked, and lo, a stormy wind came sweeping out of the north, a huge cloud and flashing fire, surrounded by a radiance, and in the center of it, in the center of the fire, a gleam as of amber. In the center of it were also the figures of four creatures, and this was their appearance. They had the figures of human beings. However, each had four faces, and each of them had four wings. The legs of each were fused into a single rigid leg, and the feet of each were like a single calf's hoof, and their sparkle was like the luster of burnished bronze. They had human hands below their wings. The four of them hid their faces and their wings on their four sides. Each one's wings touched those of the other. They did not turn when they moved. Each could move in the direction of any of its faces. Each of them had a human face at the front. Each of the four had the face of a lion on the right. Each of the four had the face of an ox on the left. And each of the four had the face of an eagle at the back. Such were their faces. As for their wings, they were separated, but each had two touching those of the others, while the other two covered its body, and each could move in the direction of any of its faces. They went wherever the Spirit impelled them to go without turning when they moved. Such then was the appearance of the creatures. With them was something that looked like burning coals of fire. This fire, suggestive of torches, kept moving about among the creatures. The fire had a radiance, and lightning issued from the fire. Dashing to and fro among the creatures was something that looked like flares. As I gazed on the creatures, I saw one wheel on the ground next to each of the four-faced creatures. As for the appearance and structure of the wheels, they gleamed like beryl, B-E-R-Y-L. All four had the same form. The appearance and structure of each was as of two wheels cutting through each other. And when they moved, each could move in the direction of any of its four quarters. They did not veer when they moved. Their rims were tall and frightening, for the rims of all four were covered all over with eyes. And when the creatures moved forward, the wheels moved at their sides. And when the creatures were borne above the earth, the wheels were borne too. Wherever the Spirit impelled them to go, they went. Wherever the Spirit impelled them, and the wheels were borne alongside them, for the spirit of the creatures was in the wheels. When these moved, these moved. When those moved, these moved. When those stood still, these stood still. And when those were born above the earth, the wheels were born alongside them, for the spirit of the creatures was in the wheels. Above the heads of the creatures was a form, an expanse, with an awe-inspiring gleam as of crystal, was spread out above their heads. Under the expanse, each had one pair of wings extended toward those of the others, and each had another pair covering its body. When they moved, I could hear the sound of their wings like the sound of mighty waters, like the sound of Shaddai, whatever that means here, the Almighty, a tumult like the din of an army. When they stood still, they would let their wings droop. From above the expanse over their heads came a sound. When they stood still, they would let their wings droop. Above the expanse over their heads was the semblance of a throne. Crucial now. Right? Above all of this was the semblance of a throne, in appearance like sapphire. And on top, upon this semblance of a throne, there was the semblance of a human form. From what appeared as his loins up, I saw a gleam as of amber, what looked like a fire encased in a flame. And from what appeared as his loins down, I saw what looked like fire. There was radiance all about him, like the appearance of the bow which shines in the clouds on a day of rain. Such was the appearance of the surrounding eight radiance. That was the appearance, the semblance of the presence of the Lord. When I beheld it, I flung myself down on my face, and I heard the voice of someone speaking. And it then goes on, and thus the Lord then said to me. It's an incredible chapter of scripture. And it sounds like he's high. It's an absolutely amazing description, although I'm sure even as I read it to you, it's not, you sort of want to see pictures of this. What is he talking about? These are faces, and the faces are four faces. They're human and they're animal, and there is a tremendous amount of fire and light. It's an utterly amazing description. And of course, on top of all of this is a throne. And seated on the throne, of course, is by implication here God. And he almost uses anthropomorphic language to talk about his loins, above his loins and below his loins. Although, as soon as he does that, he uses colors and sparkles and lights. Okay? This is the Merkabah. This is the Merkabah, means the chariot. And the chariot is something that sits on wheels, that carries something on it. And this is the scriptural source of what we are talking about when we refer to the Merkabah, the Merkabah. The experience of God, as described by Ezekiel, may not be a common experience, but for many people, at least sometime, it's a very desirable experience. It's an experience that some people would love to have a close and real sense that one is in the divine presence. And that presence is a presence of another reality entirely. You see it in its most pristine form here in Ezekiel. It is quite clear that by the time of the Talmud, okay, now Ezekiel, I said, was, he is writing this in the fifth year of the exile of Jehoiachin. That's how he introduced it. So the destruction of the temple was in 586 BCE. Okay, you're talking now about the sixth century. We are now in the Talmud, in the Mishnah, which is the year 200 CE. So we're talking seven to 800 years later. Okay? When I said to you before that we have come to understand much more because of the small amount of literature that we still have from that period of time, that is literature of, as I said, the Apocrypha and the Pseudepigrapha. It is literature in the Book of Enoch, in the Apocrypha. There are several books of Enoch. And these books talk a similar language, but they're considerably later than Ezekiel himself. This subject has, as I said, been studied a lot in the last 40 years, 50 years. Professor Gershom Scholem of the Hebrew University was the first to write on the origins of the Kabbalah. And the origins of the Kabbalah, when we use the term Kabbalah, in fact, what we normally are referring to is not this, but something that began at the latter part of the 13th century, in about 1270, in Spain, with the authorship of the Zohar. But there are roots that come before that. There is a literature that comes considerably before that, almost century by century before that period of time. There are mystical tracts that we begin to learn about. And Sholem, the great professor of Jewish mysticism at the Hebrew University, was the first one to really study and write on this. About a year and a half ago, I was at the Hebrew University and looked at his library. His library is now a separate area in the Jewish National Library. And if you want to just read a general, quick introduction to the subject, his Major Trends in Jewish Mysticism is a classic. It is one of the great classics of modern Jewish scholarship. It has been superseded by other works, but it is so classic that, you know, great classic books never are superseded. They're always superseded and they're never superseded. So if you read Sholem's Major Trends in Jewish Mysticism, any chapter, it's magnificent. It's absolutely magnificent. And here's a chapter on Merkabah and Hechalot mysticism. The Merkabah mysticism is early Jewish mysticism. Again, I'm putting the timeline. It's about 1,000 years before the Kabbalah. Okay? But what comes to be known as the Kabbalah really develops in at least 1,000 years, in probably 1,600 years. It's coming from something having to do with Ezekiel, right? And there is a lot of sophisticated thought post then. The modern scholar who has written extensively on this subject is Professor Peter Schaefer. Peter Schaefer is a professor of religion at Princeton. He's a German. I've never met Schaefer. I've always wondered about him because he grew up in Germany and for many years was professor in Berlin. Worked a long time at the Hebrew University and is now professor at Princeton. And his first work on the subject was a book called The Hidden and Manifest God, Some Major Themes in Early Jewish Mysticism. This was 1992. And he most recently published The Origins of Jewish Mysticism. Princeton University Press put it out in 2011. So what Schaefer does is to really study, beginning with the second chapter of, well, not beginning with, but very much focused on the second chapter here of Chagiga, and trying to bring together and separate the strands. It's one of the things that Schaefer says is that what scholarship tries to do is to show that how everything is related to everything else. He says scholarship frequently overdoes that. Sometimes these are just interesting strands of the human mind that may have some influence, but may not really be as directly related as we like to think of them as if they are. So when we talk about Maaseh Merkabah, and the Mishnah is referring to Merkabah, don't depend. I mean, you can read the Art Scroll commentary. The Art Scroll is not going to tell you what I've just told you. What I'm telling you is the result of modern scholarship. This material, and it'll be true throughout the material we've been reading, is very pregnant with possibility of metaphor. So many of these things, I mean, Ezekiel's words were filled with extraordinary metaphors. And naturally, as soon as you get that snowball going, it's just going to keep going. Because you can say, well, I think the metaphor means this, and I think it means that, and so on. There's no end to that. There really is no end. And there is no end. There is no end. However, in order to focus on it historically, I think that the work of Sholem and Schaefer, to some extent here in New York, Professor Elliot Wolfson at NYU has also done work in this field. Schaefer is, I think, the one who has had the most to say. But now we know what Maaseh Merkava is. When the Talmud is talking about it, it is talking about a mystical system or a mystical predisposition that many, or at least some people were drawn to, and by people I mean rabbis, the rabbis of the Talmud themselves, were drawn to this. It was obviously something perceived, at least by the author of the Mishnah, to be problematic. Right? Because remember, when we say you can't do in three, and you can't do in two, and you can't do in one, which is the one? The one is Maaseh Merkabah. Right? That's the dangerous stuff. And you know that eventually even the study of Kabbalah is very limited. It is limited to only after you have had a full diet, as they say, of Shas and Puskiv, that you know the law, and you're pious, and you're observant, and you're intelligent, and you're 40 years old. Right? You get a little bit of the heat out of the system. Begins to happen around 40, maybe. At least not the Kippur. At that point, okay, you know, we'll say it's time. Maybe you can study some Kabbalah. Okay? But this was perceived to be dangerous stuff. It was dangerous stuff. Why is it dangerous? Well, Sholem has written extensively on that. Everyone who writes on mysticism, particularly those writing on the history of Jewish mysticism, note the fact, why is it particularly dangerous in Judaism? Christian mysticism, for example. Any of you ever read Teresa of Avila, the great Spanish Catholic mystic? It's amazing stuff. Not a lot different from what I just read to you, by the way. You read Teresa of Avila, and it's a lot like the kind of language which you hear in Ezekiel. I don't know. Is she a converso? I don't. All I know is that when you read her, it's much like this. But that kind... Was she what?
She was
I believe that's... I believe that's... Well, let's not get hung up in Teresa. It's just an example. I want to get to the problem of Jewish mysticism, which was not such a... It's a potential problem in Christian mysticism, but not so much so. The problem with mysticism in general is that what the mystic seeks is a personal closeness to God and the true presence of the divine. What happens next is the potential problem. Because a person can say, I am so close to God that God has spoken to me and this is what I am supposed to do. In Judaism, that's a big problem. Because Judaism is a religion that is based on, what did I read to you in Leviticus 18, you shall do this and you shall do that. This is my law. This is the way it is. This is the law. And then what does it do next? It says, once again, by the way, this is the law. Now I'm going to tell you what the law is. Okay? So that's the Judaism. So in Jewish mysticism, there's a danger here of antinomianism, which is the possibility of the mystic reacting against the law. Could be dangerous for other reasons. Could be dangerous for social reasons. I just read the other day, who was it? David Brooks, my friend David Brooks, wrote about whether we should legalize marijuana. After the experience, you know, the Colorado's experiment, or for better or for worse. So it's something of the same issue. Any of you who have experience with either personally with drugs or with the drug world, it's potentially very antisocial. Individuals are sometimes their ability to relate to others is vastly changed, and it's not simply the availability of things, it's just what it does to you, these kinds of experiences. These are potentially dangerous from the perspective of the individual and the individual's fitting into the social structure of the community. And David, in his own way, was, I think, referring to things like that in his article in the New York Times the other day. So there are many potential fears of mysticism, and it's worthwhile keeping that in mind as we see the strictures on Merkaba. What we know from this is that it was something that people were doing. Obviously it was something. We'll see a lot more about that in the Talmud text itself. People were obviously interested in this. They were involved in it. They not only were tempted by it, but they got involved. They did it. And that is the mystic mind. The mind that seeks to be close to God.
What's the yes?
What's the
yes?
They developed methods, sometimes of reading texts, okay? Sometimes of meditation, okay? Sometimes compounding these things, or of taking the imagery from Ezekiel. And that is a goal. The goal is to read the imagery of Ezekiel and begin to internalize it and to feel that you too are rising up. Strangely enough, they usually call it Yordea Merkaba. They go down into the Merkaba, when really it's Aliyah Merkaba. You go up to the Merkaba, okay? But the Merkaba itself becomes an object of contemplation and a point of entry into the experience of the presence of God.
Every time I read that, when I just heard you read it, I am overwhelmed by it, because it's the most visceral thing that I've ever experienced in any of our and I'm amazed that it's allowed to be part of it, because it seems to me that part of the Ten Commandments, you shouldn't try to sort of inscribe what you're getting from God, that he's not going to come down in a chariot with fire. And that seems very like a dangerous, bad thing. Like, I'm amazed that Ezekiel is allowed to remain as part of the
It should be said that Ezekiel was not a slam dunk. It wasn't a slam dunk into the corpus of the Bible. Four reasons undoubtedly that are germane to what you're saying. But it made it. It did make it. Keep that also in mind as far as the Talmud goes. Look at the things that we're reading and that we're going to read. There's nothing like, just to set you up for this, there's nothing like saying, all right, class, what you are not allowed to study is sex. What do I mean by that? The relation between a man and a woman. Now, I'm going to tell you what you're not allowed to study. You're not allowed to study the human body. A man has said this, and a woman, you know, and you're not allowed to study what goes on. Why are you not allowed to study? You cannot study that the two of them come together. You can't study any of those things. In the meantime, the students are, what did he say? What did I hear? What am I listening to? You know, realize that some of that is going on here. You know, you're not allowed to study these things. I'm going to tell you what you're not allowed to study. You can't study this, you can't study that. And I'm going to make it very clear what you're not allowed to study. at least a fair amount of it will be made clear. So that the whole idea of prohibiting something is an interesting idea when you include it in the Bible and when you include it in the Talmud. This is not your whole Talmud by any means. This is 5 pages of Talmud. It's a lot more pages of the Talmud than that. But then again, it's there.
It's one of the reasons that you are paid the Merkabah, because of the danger.
Okay.
The hopes that one can manage to get back.
Of course. We'll see that. That's going to come up in the text that we're going to read. It is considered to be highly dangerous stuff. Recently, since I've been away, I've just been catching up on things. Just this week, the new issue of the JBL, the Journal of Biblical Literature, arrived. And a fellow writes an article there on fire symbolism. Fire symbolism. Good article. He makes the point that throughout the Bible has a problem with conceiving of the divine in any physical form. But then again, if you're going to talk about gods, you've got to talk about physical forms, because what else do you do? How else do you do it? So one of the most common ways the Bible does it is to talk in terms of fire. And you have that here in Ezekiel. Several different ways of talking about fire. And of course, in the desert, how do you know that the divine is present? There's a cloud and a pillar of fire. Fire. Okay? So certain physical things become very important in language. And then when you talk about mystical experience and things that, as we say, they sear your soul. What sears your soul? Fire. Fire. Among other things, this is dangerous. This is dangerous stuff. It's dangerous stuff. Remember what happens in the Torah, Parashat Acharimot, comes before that, when Nadav and Avihu, right? How are they killed? Right? They bring strange fire. And what is it that kills them? Fire. Right? Not the fire that they brought, but the fire that comes out of the altar kills them. This whole business is very dangerous. So that together with the way in which fire is searing and warming and desirable, it is equally dangerous. Okay? It destroys maybe even more than it warms.
It brings us back to when we started, when the Haggadah is a sacrifice, and all the sacrifices were laid on an altar that had on its face fire.
Mm-hmm. Correct. Correct.
Correct.
I'll go a little further. It's a good point, because the early Jewish mystics, as described by Schaeffer, and Sholem is the same thing, the early Merkabah mysticism was called Hechalot mysticism. Hechalot mysticism. Hechal is the palace or the temple. Okay? And what is being used as the basic term of metaphor here is the inner court of the temple. It's the inner court of the temple. And the inner court of the temple, of course, is a place with fire. There is fire in the outer court. There's fire in the inner court. There is an incense fire that is burning right next to the Holy of Holies. That's what we read on Yom Kippur. When the high priest goes into the Holy of Holies, comes out, and does splashings, that's right next to the fire of the incense altar. He takes the incense and brings it into the Holy of Holies. So all of this is very much connected with the fire symbolism, and even the language of Echal becomes the language of the Merkabah mystics. That they are talking about fire and the temple itself and mystical experience is designed ultimately to bring the individual into the Holy of Holies. Right? the individual can be brought into the Holy of Holies. And of course, when the Kohen Gadol leaves the Holy of Holies, remember what we read then after the Avodah service, he comes out and he utters a prayer saying he thanks God that he comes out alive. Thanks God that he comes out. Because all of this is on the one hand so privileged. It is the most privileged kind of religious experience. On the other hand, it's extremely dangerous.
When you were reading the Ezekiel, my thoughts went to Aaron's sons.
Exactly.
The Holy of Holies and just
kill them. Exactly. So in Ezekiel, it's a positive thing. There, it's a negative thing.
Respecting Rabbi, so Ezekiel was at a time where large segments of the Jewish population and Israel were engaged in idolatry. I mean, there was the divide, the people who were believed, you know, who were following the proper ways, and there were others. And then we flash forward to the time of the Mishnah, where we have Christianity on the rise. Does it make sense that, looking back on it now, the Tanaim are worried that, just as at the time of Ezekiel there was kind of the distinction between understanding God versus idols, now we're in a period now at the time of the Mishnah where there is discussion of other people talking about different seeing God and speaking for God and sons of God, and it leads to a feeling that this has to be very high fence around this sort of thing because this is very dangerous now.
Well, let's take a specific look at the historical period then. Realize the historical period you're talking about here is post the destruction of the temple, okay? Where you no longer have any access to the Holy of Holies. So in fact, what you might argue is that you're creating another point of access. You're not only creating a point of access, you're saying that you can come close to God, as Ezekiel did, but in addition to that, it's democratizing the whole thing. It's democratizing the point of access, because without the sacrificial system, without the priesthood, without a high priest, suddenly it becomes possible for me to go into the Holy of Holies. And am I up to it? You know, the Torah never gave me the right to do it. This is all sort of creative religious thinking. Wow, this could be really dangerous. I'm just updating the possibility, which I think you very rightly raised, of historical context. Okay? Yes, sir.
Why did you not mention Mount Sinai? That was the point that the change between being nomad and becoming under one God, under a tremendous ceremony. I don't know if it was a ceremony, but it was a very important mystical, I would call it.
Correct.
If you don't take, mention it.
Well, they don't mention that here. It's very interesting. You're right. Some of the symbolism used by Ezekiel, though, is symbolism from Mount Har Sinai. It's the colors, for example. In Parshat Mishpatim, the end of Parshat Mishpatim, the elders are brought to feast at the divine with God, and at that point they see him the color of sapphire. Color of sapphire, which is exactly what Ezekiel is talking about. I think that they're not bringing it up, and it doesn't become an important framework for the discussion of mysticism, because in classical Judaism it's so absolute. That is to say, Har Sinai sets up the whole system. Mount Sinai sets up the whole system. Gives you the Torah. Right? That's what this religion is about. This religion is about the Torah that came on Mount Sinai and what that was. It's unique. And crucial to everything is its absolute uniqueness. It is unique. It is unique. Nothing like it ever happens again. It's public revelation, among other things, which is part of its uniqueness. So it is never used really as a point of reference for personal religious experience. Although you can articulate the similarities, for example, there too. Before Moses goes up finally to get the Ten Commandments, remember, he has to make sure that the people don't come too near to the mountain. Why? Because it's the same thing. It's the fire. It's the danger of the fire. It's the danger of too much divine. Okay? So there are many similarities, but it doesn't become a paradigm that's used in later Jewish mysticism. Rather, the rabbis and Jewish mystics in general make use of, let's call it the loose paradigm, the paradigm of Ezekiel. Right? That's there for everybody to use to take and to make of it a goal of personal religious experience. Yes.
I think it's interesting that Sheol is cold and you have this warmth and fire is a positive reflection of God. Christian theology, hell,
it's hot.
Is really hot. And so I think the issue of metaphor and people look at sort of the neurobiologic basis of why we choose metaphors like, say someone is warm, that's a positive statement. It could just as well have been cold. There's nothing obvious about why one would be so attached.
Mm-hmm.
But the way the neurobiologists talk about this, the association is with being cuddled by the mother. And so when neurons fire, meaning the pleasure of the protection of the mother becomes associated with the warmth of the mother's body and impresses the relationship, and that we then wind up with metaphors that in fact reflect those utilization of those past cards. But it's just interesting that hell was looked on still very differently.
Well, you'll see when we get just a little bit further, because we have to figure out what we mean by above and below, before and after. Because remember, the Mishnah said that you're not supposed to study those things. You're not supposed to look above and below. So could that mean the below that you're talking about? Okay? But keep it in mind. We'll see it. We're going to get to it in the text. Now let's do a little bit of Gemara. Okay? We go till 9, so you have almost 15 minutes. The Arts Scrolls 11b3. Amra Bereisha, you say in the beginning of the Mishnah, V'lo b'merka b'biyachit. Okay, you say that, it's not the beginning of the Mishnah, the end of the Mishnah, sort of toward the end of the Mishnah, that you're not allowed to teach Masei Merkava, even to an individual, unless that person is able to learn on his own. The Adar Amart, and then following that you say, Elaim Kena Yachacham Mevin Midato, unless the person was able to understand by himself. Well, anybody who can understand by himself has got to be a scholar to begin with. And so you don't have to teach that person. It's in a way saying nothing. Right? If what it means, if what the Mishnah means is that a person is only to teach himself, why does it say what it says? It just doesn't make sense the way it expounds it. Hachikamar, rather, we should understand it as follows. Ein dorshin ba'arayot lishlosha. You are not allowed to teach arayot to three people. Not three including the teacher. Right? Rashi set us up for the way the Mishnah, the Gemara understands it at first, but that's the misunderstanding. When it says you're not allowed to do it with three, that means two students and the teacher. Right? Not with three means two. So you can do arayot with two and the teacher. V'loba ma'ase bereishit lishnayim, nor one may expound ma'ase bereishit to two other people, right? The teacher and two other people. V'loba merkava liyachid, and you can't teach Merkaba to even a single person, that doesn't mean the teacher by himself. It means the teacher has one student. But that one student is able to understand, is wise and able to understand on his own. So that was finally the Gemara's explaining the Mishnah the way we, I think, read it to begin with. That's really what it means. It means teaching to that number of people. Okay? Ein dorshim ba'ariot bishlosha. You cannot teach ariot to three. So it means you can teach it to two. My tama. How do we know? What's the reason for that? Now, the Gemara, those of you who have studied Gemara know that what the Talmud usually likes to do is to find some verse to learn it from. The Mishnah comes and teaches us something, so what verse is it based on? How do you know that? So the Mishnah says, Ilema mishum dichtiv. If you want to say that it is because of what is written in the scriptures, ish ish el kol she'er b'saro. That's the beginning of Leviticus 18 that I read to you. Ish ish el she'er kol b'saro. Right? A man, oh, so it mentions man once, man twice. El she'er b'saro, to his near kin of flesh, that's a third person. One, two. What? So you said it means each. It could mean that. No, that's Hebrew. It might mean that. Or remember in rabbinic exposition, rabbinic exegesis, if something is repeated, usually there's a law to be learned from it. It doesn't mean just each. Right? There's a certain hermeneutic rules that usually will pertain. So the question is, does this mean one, two, three? Right? Two students and a teacher. All right? Now listen to how the Gemara deals with that. The Gemara then goes on and says, by the way, the verse goes on and says, V'amar Rachmana, the verse continues and says, Lo tikrevu legalot erva. You shall not draw together to reveal nakedness. That's to say, you can't teach about those things. Maybe that's the way you understand the beginning of Leviticus 18. That's what it means. But if that makes sense, if that's logic that you think really works, look at this. Ish ish ki yekalel Elohav. The Torah also says, ish ish, a man who will curse his God. So you just told me, if you repeat the word ish, it means two people. So does that mean that the prohibition against cursing God is only if two people curse God? Okay. Ish, ish, asher yiten mizara lamolech. Torah says, ish, ish, a man, who shall give of his seed to molech. You know what that meant. That meant the killing of children. Right? The offering of children is an offering, is a sacrifice to molech. So does that mean only if two people offer their one child? That's ridiculous. We know that all those laws pertain to each individual. It doesn't require two people. So because something is repeated, doesn't it all mean that it refers to separate people? Not at all. Elahanu mebayele lerabot et anochrim. But the Gemara then goes on to say where ish ish is repeated, it does have a halachic significance. It's not just each person. That doesn't mean that. It means that in those cases, the law is extended to Gentiles as well as Jews. Fascinating idea. That Gentiles, according to the law of the Torah, you know, Gentiles are not subject to the law of the Torah by and large. Gentile doesn't have to observe the Sabbath. Gentile doesn't have to fast on Yom Kippur. Right? Gentile, certain things may make sense for Gentiles to do, but none of those laws are incumbent on Gentiles. However, there are seven Noahide commandments. We call them the Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach. There are laws that are considered universal laws that are related to all people. Okay? And among the laws that relate to all people are the laws of Arayot. the laws of forbidden sexual relations. Incest is a human issue and not a Jewish issue. It's a human issue and not a Jewish issue. Okay? It's very interesting that even in Jewish law that was considered. Fascinating, the church accepted all of this as in fact applying to Gentiles. It was until just very recently, but still it's basically the law. In most cases, little changes have been made, but it's largely still the law. And it's based on the law of the Torah. Based on the law of the Torah. Okay? And that's because, according to rabbinic law, it says, ish, ish. So, the bottom line is, you can't learn from that two students. You can't learn from that two students. There's another ramification to which is much more important. All right? The Gemara then goes on. And down to the bottom of 11b3. Ela midichtiv. Rather, it is derived from that which is written, Ushmartem et mishmarti. You shall observe my safeguard, which it said in the Leviticus 18. Ushmartem tre, mishmarti chat. Ushmartem, you shall guard, is in the plural. It's in the plural. Observe. You shall observe. It's in the plural. Shmartem. Plural you. Mishmarti, singular. Okay? Minimal plural is how many?
Two.
Plus one. What do we have? Three. Okay? We have a teacher and two students. Okay? So, the Gemara then offers that as a possible scriptural verse to prove that it's two students. Two students. Then the Gemara says, V'amar rachmana levilti asot mechukot. No, that just goes on. Okay? Ela me'ata, but if that's true, I'm on 11b4. Me'ata dichtiv ushmartem et ha-shabbat. It also says, ushmartem et ha-shabbat. You shall keep the Sabbath. Does that only mean in pairs? Right? That's a plural. Ushmartem et ha-shabbat. You shall keep the Sabbath. If you're telling me that when it says ushmartem, it means a pair, then only two people can keep the Sabbath? One person doesn't have to keep the Sabbath. If you're by yourself, you don't have to keep the Sabbath. Ridiculous. That doesn't work either. Okay? Ushmartem et mishmeret hakodesh. You shall safeguard the charge of the holy. Hachinami. Same thing would apply here. That doesn't work. How could you say that? Okay, so we have not succeeded in finding the source of why it is two students and a teacher. And if you want to find out why, you must come back next week. Okay.